BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longman.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Dillis Powell, Dennis Norton, Anne Scott James, and Frank Muir. Test round one to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the right answer. Dillis Powell first. What is a pittite? P-I-T-T-I-T-E. Pittite.
Somebody who sits in a pit.
Where?
In a pit.
Which kind of pit?
A theatrical pit.
That'll do. 2 marks it is. Pittite is somebody occupying a seat in the pit of the theatre, and it usually is applied to people who are regularly there, regular habitués of the pit. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, what is an avadavet? A-V-A-D-A-V-A-T, or if we prefer it, and it helps, an amadavat.
Oh, that I'd have been in trouble without that one, yeah. I've copied it down, but I think I've got one vava. Too many. Avavadat.
That's right.
Avavadat. Avadabat is a kind of noise that I once stayed at a hotel in the Midlands that the bed springs made. Avadabat. Would it be terribly humiliating if I said I haven't got the faintest idea?
Is it Indian? Is it Indian?
Yes.
Is it anything to do with a nurse? An
yeah.
Amma? You sort of gave that vague hint that it would help. No, it
is Indian. You're quite right. No,
let's go from there.
Not unless nurses have wings.
Oh, yes. Sort of ornithological nursing mother.
That could be. I would be prepared to call an ornithological nursing mother an abadabba.
I'll give you 1 out of 2 for knowing it was Indian. An Amma or Avadavat is a small Indian songbird, which I'm reliably informed is brown in colour with white spots. And it's named after the place where it normally frequents, which is Ahmedabad. And Scott James, what is a scaldino? S-C-A-L-D-I-N-O, scaldino.
Well, it must be Italian.
Yes.
I'll get a mark for that.
Yes.
And caldo is the Italian for hot.
Yes.
So it's something of a hot nature.
It is.
Mm-mm. I think it's a sort of operatic word. I think it's the man who chases all the girls in an opera. Sort of hot one.
No. He sings scaldino, means he sings like a scalded cat.
Well, then it must be something to do with hot water or a hot stove or a barbecue. It's a barbecue.
Hot stove is very, very close indeed. You're doing very well.
Well, it's a hot Italian hot stove.
Yes, and where do you put it?
Suggestions.
It's a small heating device used by elderly women in Italy, and it's an earthenware pot with a handle, rather like a basket handle, about 8 inches across, and peasant women fill them with hot charcoal, and they tuck them under their voluminous petticoats to keep themselves warm. So though the respectable dictionaries call this a hand or foot warmer, the lady who supplied us with this very, very useful information says she prefers to think of them as thigh warmers.
Sorry, just think of a few blistered Neapolitan gentlemen's hands.
Mafia to you. Well, back to Frank Miller. Frank, what is your sinciput? S-I-N-C-I-P-U-T, sinciput.
My mind's gone blank.
Well, you're very
sinciput. Sinciput put the question.
Thank you. Very, very close to the answer.
Is there anything to do with occiput?
Yes, the opposite end.
Well, it's your feet, then.
No, sorry. No. The opposite part.
The occiput's the back of your head.
Yes, well, the opposite part.
I was kicked on it. Obviously. With the front of your head?
Yes. 1%. 1.5. I did do some health there. Simply put, is the head, if you can think of it this way, which I find rather difficult, from the start of your forehead to the top of the head, whereas occiput is the top of your head to the nape of your neck. So these are the two halves, and it does...
The occiput.
No, it's a Latin word, and it comes from a word meaning just half head, but it happens to be the front half. Before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then I hope that the two women members of the team will go on studying the quotations, because at the end, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Dillis Powell and Frankner, your quotation is, "One good turn deserves another." And Anne, with Dennis Norden, yours is, "Up, up, my friend, and quit your books." And at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round two is a round of Shavian characters, and I want to know in what play by George Bernard Shaw do the following characters appear? 2 marks again. Dennis Powell, Captain Shotover.
Heartbreak House.
Absolutely splendid. Written in 1917, and Captain Shotover is a splendid character. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, a character I'm sure will appeal to you, King Magnus.
Yes, that was the king who stood as Member of Parliament for Windsor. Yes,
that's right.
That's the apple cart.
Well done. 2 marks it is. Now, Anne Scott James, Dubedat. D-U-B-E-D-A-T. Dubedat.
Oh, is that the doctor's dilemma?
Yes, 2 marks it is. Dubedat was the, not im, but amoral artist, I suppose you could call him, in The Doctor's Dilemma, which was Shaw's satire on the competence and ethics of the medical profession as it then was. Thank you. Andrew Undershaft.
Was he not the father of the girl after whom the play was named?
Yes. And the play?
Major Barbara.
Well done. 2 marks. Well done. Major Barbara was the play, and Barbara herself was a Salvation Army major, Major Barbara, and Andrew Undershaft was her papa, and he was a kind of armaments tycoon with the right kind of enlightened Shavian views. Well, now we have a round of brief questions on our old pals from Greek mythology, and I want brief answers on one side of the paper only. Dennis Powell, who was Polyphemus, and how did Odysseus and his men escape from Polyphemus?
Polyphemus was a giant with one eye who kept affectionately a lot of sheep.
Yes.
And Ulysses and his companions were somehow trapped by this large gentleman, and they escaped by tying themselves under the stomachs of the sheep, and poor old Polyphemus, who only had one eye, never saw them.
Yes.
He got out.
Something had happened to his eye by then.
Oh, by then, I think they'd run. They were not very nice to him. They'd run a sort of stake into the eye that there was.
Yes, sir. Yes.
And he was so angry that when they got into their ships, he flung a very large rock at them.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Dead sheep.
two marks to this.
Hold on.
Dennis Norden, we know the expression "a sop to Cerberus" and what it means, but what was the first original "sop to Cerberus"?
Well, it means it for Frank's benefit, this is not to delay matters slightly. While I think. "Sop to Cerberus" is when you give a traffic warden a boiled sweet.
Yeah.
Poison. Cerberus was a dog, wasn't he?
A kind of dog, yes.
It's not the salt, is it? No, that's not. he was a dog, and he was something to do with when you died. He was something to do with ferrying you over the river. He was either the ferry keeper's dog or something, and you dropped him something in order to...
bung him.
You bunged him something in order to curry favour.
Yes, which side of the river sticks?
Which side? You mean our side or...
Our side or theirs.
Ah.
It must have been... who went down there?
Yes.
No, Virgil went.
You're getting there. Yes.
Aeneas went down, didn't he?
You're there.
And he threw him the doped sock.
Yes.
To put him to sleep so that he could go across to see the shade.
That's right. 2 marks it is. You've got it absolutely right. Cerberus was a not very nice three-headed dog with hair like of snakes who guarded the entrance to Hades or Hell. And as Anne quite rightly says, the Trojan Aeneas was taken by the Sibyl to this underworld. And the only way of getting past the gatekeeper, this three-headed dog, was a drugged cake, which the dog greedily lapped up. And he went to sleep and they got in. Anne Scott-James, we know that Scylla and Charybdis were two horrors to be avoided by the Greek mariners of old, but what precisely were they?
Well, Charybdis was a whirlpool.
Yes.
And Scylla was a monster which had a lot of heads on a lot of necks. Mm. How many? Six, I think.
Yes, quite right.
It was a six-headed monster, and it used to sort of, on very long necks, its heads would come out and snatch sailors from the ships that passed by.
Well done. Absolutely accurate and well done. Dumas. Scylla had six inconveniently long necks and six absolutely horrible heads, and they seized and devoured the sailors, who, if they were rash enough to stand on deck as they sailed past her cave where she lived. Charybdis was a highly dangerous whirlpool off the coast of Sicily, and possibly all this happened in the Straits of Messina, as they're now called. Frank Muir, what were the Pythian Games? P-Y-T-H-I-A-N, Pythian Games.
Sack race and the egg and spoon. We think drawing a bow at a venture. They happened at Delphi.
They did. Yes, or just below. Yes, quite right. And
what?
What was sacred?
They're sacred.
Yes, they are.
Sacred games.
Very sacred indeed.
Yes. In Delphi, just below Delphi.
Yes, in the
just
garden.
On the bottom of the hill, where
that's
in
right.
The valley.
Where it was fair. Yes.
To Apollo. Mm. To Apollo.
Yes?
To Apollo.
I think that'll do.
Go.
You are.
Anything you want to know, Jack, don't hesitate.
Now, this time I won't. Pythian games originated because Apollo, the god, killed a serpent who was called not Python, but Python, who rose out of the mud left after the great flood, the flood of Deucalion in this case, with Noah in a different legend. And the Python lived in caves on Mount Parnassus around Delphi, and was killed by Apollo, who, in order to celebrate his victory, established these games, which were next in importance, the Olympic Games, and rather like our Commonwealth Games, they came in sort of intermediate years between the actual Olympiad. And now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Anne Scott-James, can you give me the origin of the quotation, "Up, up, my friend, and quit your books"?
I think it was by William Wordsworth.
Yes, that's good enough. "Up, up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you will grow double. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble?" Wordsworth in a poem called "The Tables Turned." It goes on with the theme, "Let nature be your teacher." Now, Dennis Powell, the origin of yours, please. "One good turn deserves another."
It's a proverb.
Mm-hmm.
The legend again.
Comes out of Aesop, I think, had it once, didn't he? Did Aesop have it?
That's a jolly good shot. I don't remember it, but...
Aesop had it, yes.
You may well be right.
Aesop.
Two marks, right. It is a proverb. I think it first occurs, as far as I know, in a Latin manuscript in the John Ryland's library, and then it's in John Haywood's celebrated collection of proverbs in 1550, "One good turn asketh another." Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and for this round, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back to Dennis Norton and his quotation, "Up, up, my friend, and quit your books."
If I ever get asked, "What was your most memorable Christmas?" I have an answer. It was last Christmas. What it all gets down to is this
complicated business of the Christmas presents which Frank and I give to each other to make sure that I spend exactly the same amount on the present that I give to him as he spends on the present that he gives to me, and I can't go out and buy the present I give to him until I've received the present that he gives to me and can therefore calculate that price. Now, last year, it was a beautiful suitcase, fully packed with tropical clothes. See, with Frank, it's not the gift, it's the thought behind it. So immediately I went to my catalogues and priced it. £37.10 that boy had spent. Well, I knew what to spend, but now there was a snag. It was 6 o'clock Christmas Eve, and the shops were shut. What could I give him? Well, I didn't like to give him money because he's not used to it. And then I suddenly remembered cigarette coupons. I have a lot, I save cigarette coupons. Now, pricing cigarette coupons as being worth roughly a penny each, I worked out I could give him 9,000 cigarette coupons in return. And I looked up the catalogue that the cigarette people get, and some beautiful things you can get with 9,000 cigarette coupons. There was an ant colony. There was a wrought iron fire escape. The things that, you know, a boy can really play with. So then another snag. It was now about 7, and the post office was shut. But with me, as soon as a snag arises, there's always a brainwave to solve it. I thought, well, instead of making a parcel, I'll put them in letters and post them to him, you see. Well, I then took the envelopes to the letterbox on the corner. It was now about 11:30 on Christmas Eve, and I started popping them through. Now, the trouble is, the letterbox was almost full. You know, there are an awful lot of irresponsible, thoughtless people who leave their postal of Christmas gifts at the very last minute. And I was left with one holding 50 that I just couldn't get through. So what I did, I just pushed it into the slot, which was bung up. Then I stepped back a pace, and I'm fairly tall, raised a leg, and pushed it. Now, it was in that position that I stood for the next 18 hours. It's very difficult to get your foot out of a letterbox once you get it in. Now, I'm not going to dwell on the details of that day, the passers-by who paused and sniggered, the others who went on, came back with cameras. Not even that rotten little fox terrier who... All I will mention is this, that at 4:30, just as it was beginning to snow, who should stroll by but Frank? Now, you're in a peculiarly vulnerable position, standing with one leg stuck upwards through a letterbox, particularly when you're facing somebody who has not received the Christmas present that he had calculated down to the last penny. But I will say this for Frank. His behavior was absolutely wonderful. He pulled the other leg away. Not a word about his Christmas present. All I heard from him as he bent down to grasp my ankle was just an echo of Wordsworth. Up, up, my friend, and quit your box.
Now we go back to Frank Muir. His quotation was, "One good turn deserves another."
It's request night tonight, so hands up those who'd like to hear how to build a low-curved brick wall. Now, to build a brick wall, you need bricks, you need mortar, which is made of cement, sand, you need water, you need gumboots, you need gloves, a piece of string, you need a spade, a bucket, and a doctor. First of all, you mark out your curve in front of the front door. Then you come to the next process, which is mixing the mortar. For this, you just you get a sack of cement, ordinary 100-weight brown paper sack of cement, and you lift that up and you take... Well, that's where you need the doctor. But nowadays, keyhole surgery, you know. Hernia's nothing to worry about. A fortnight and you're absolutely as good as new. You now have your cement mixed and you're prepared to lay your bricks. I bought a book on this, which I don't recommend. It was called Learn to Lay Bricks. When you think... It could well have been written by a chicken. When you think of it... somebody... Books should be written by authors. A man who knows how to lay bricks is a bricklayer. And he doesn't know how to write books. It took me 20 minutes to master how to pick the brick up. Each of the faces... Anyway, you hold the brick in your left hand, and you weigh it, and you feel it. It said, savour your brick. And you toss it up and down your hand a couple of times, and all the skin comes off the end of your finger. You then pick up a trowel of the cement, and you fling it lightly onto the brick. You then find that your wristwatch strap is covered in cement. And there's none on the brick. So you then drop the trowel and pick up a handful of cement and press it firmly along the top of the brick. You then turn the brick over and the cement falls off it. Whatever you do, when you put the cement on, you have to turn it and it falls off again. Eventually, well, the thing to do is to drop the brick entirely, use both hands on the... Get on your knees, you see. Get down to the pile of cement. Get a couple of handfuls of it and just sort of slosh it down on the ground and then slap the brick onto it, you see. Then when you come to the second course, you also do the same. Otherwise, it just falls off and goes in your gumboot. Instantly, you can't get the gumboot off at nine because the cement's hardened. Then when you've finished your three courses of bricks, you then stand there and lean against it and it falls over. That's all I've got time for this week. Well, there's one thing I omitted to tell you is that when I was building this wall, I always hum when I'm working, you know. And make up little snatches of melody, you know. I never do anything with these. I never give them to anybody or sell them. It's not really, but when I was making that curved wall, you see, what being stuck in this gumboot for a fortnight and whatnot, I made up a whole complete melody, and it's so good, you know, a whole tune, that I'm going to send it to all the way to Hollywood, to Las Vegas. Because little melodies, you know, you make up when you build a curved brick wall are not worth bothering about. But I think, you know, I agree with the old saying that one good tune deserves Sinatra.
Well, by your vote and very narrow margin, the contest of the two stories is won by Dennis Norton. But nevertheless, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir win the entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. Thank you.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.